The headlines: Palestinian officials denounce the Israeli assassination of a journalist and say further reveals the savage face of the occupiers. The U.S. House passes a $40 billion funding bill for Ukraine, including more than $20 billion in military aid. Plus, Tehran calls for the immediate release of an Iranian diplomat who's being imprisoned in Belgium on terror-related charges. Hello and welcome, everybody. It's our top story for this half hour. Israeli forces kill a reporter working for the Qatar-based Al Jazeera TV network in the occupied West Bank. Shireen Abu Akleh was fatally shot in the head while covering an Israeli army raid on the city of Jenin, as can be seen in the footage. She was wearing a blue flak jacket clearly marked with press at the moment of shooting. Abu Akleh was a veteran Palestinian reporter for Al Jazeera's Arab language channel. The broadcaster called her killing a horrifying crime in violation of international norms. Qatar condemned the incident as a state-sponsored Israeli terrorism. The Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, says Abu Akleh's killing lays bare the terroristic and violent nature of the occupying regime. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, another reporter, Ali Samoudi, sustained injuries during the attack. Our Ramallah correspondent, Mona Kandil, told us how Israeli forces treat journalists covering and trying to reveal the regime's crimes against Palestinians.
Well, we have to say that this news is really shocking for all Palestinian journalists here in the occupied territories. It's another proof that the Israeli army doesn't differentiate between journalists who try their best to reveal the Israeli crimes to the whole world. A journalist or a normal Palestinian, or for them, all the Palestinians could be targeted at the time of fighting, let's say, or Israeli incursion to any of the Palestinian areas. Many Palestinians had been wounded in several incidents. Palestinian journalists suffer suffocation every time they take part in protests and demonstrations. Many of them had been martyred. Numerous Palestinian journalists were wounded, seriously wounded during these incursions. Even at the time we Palestinian journalists tried to show the Israeli soldiers that we are oppressed or journalists, and that we have the right, according to the international law, to cover what's going on. However, they try to force us out of the cover and prevent us to clearly cover the clashes or their crimes.
On May 10th, 2021, Israel launched a war on Gaza, killing and injuring hundreds of civilians, including women and children. The war came to an end after 11 days. That followed fierce resistance by Palestinian factions who launched thousands of rockets against the regime, forcing it to declare a unilateral ceasefire. Asher Shannon brings us the following story from Gaza.
A year ago, Israeli regime forces bombed hundreds of buildings in the Gaza Strip during the 11-day war, also known as the Sword of Al-Quds Battle. The wanton Israeli attacks claimed the lives of over 260 Palestinians, including scores of children and women. The Gaza-based resistance groups Mili Hamas, the Islamic Jihad, and the Popular Resistance Committees also fired some 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzeddin al-Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli attacks on Palestinians in Al-Quds' Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Overwhelmed by the significantly developed military capabilities of Palestinian resistance factions, the Israeli regime was forced to announce a unilateral ceasefire.
During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinian resistance factions fired thousands of rockets against the Zionist regime, forcing it to desperately call for a ceasefire after 11 days. The resistance is prepared to respond to any aggression, and nowadays the military capabilities of the resistance are better than last year. The Zionist enemy must understand that attacking Al-Quds will result in a new war.
The 11-day war saw the heaviest fighting between Gaza resistance factions and Israeli regime forces since 2014. Over the past decade, Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza have been boosting their production capacity for homemade rockets and drones. During the May war, Israel's Iron Dome also proved to be a failure. The multi-million-dollar high-tech missile system was unable to protect the Israeli regime.
During the 11-day war last year, 2021, Hamas and the Palestinians scored very well against Israel in a number of things. One is the launching of rockets against Israel closed very much Israeli airports, port, and the Israeli business community. In addition to that, the Palestinians succeeded in unifying all fronts.
The Israeli regime has waged four wars on the Gaza Strip since 2007 under the watchful eye of the international community.
Experts believe in any future war, the Israeli regime will be dealt a heavy blow by Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
The U.S. House approves an additional $40 billion in financial and military aid for Ukraine to help it in the ongoing war with Russia. The aid package, which needs the Senate approval, is more than the U.S. president had initially requested from lawmakers. If approved, this would push the U.S. aid for Ukraine to over $50 billion since the launch of the Russian military operation there. The figure is about $6 billion more than the total U.S. spending on all its foreign and military aid in 2019. Moscow has repeatedly warned that such aid by the U.S. and its European allies would only worsen the situation. The Kremlin has also warned that the arming of Ukraine may lead to a direct confrontation between Russia and the West. The war between Russia and Ukraine is in its 76th day, but the United States says the conflict may turn into a war of attrition.
The next month or two of fighting will be significant as the Russians attempt to reinvigorate their efforts, but even if they are successful, we are not confident that the fight in the Donbas will effectively end the war. We assess President Putin is preparing for a prolonged conflict in Ukraine, during which he still intends to achieve goals beyond the Donbas.
The U.S. Director of National Intelligence says she sees no path forward for the peace talks between Moscow and Kiev, at least in the short term. The U.S. official also predicts the fighting could take unpredictable turns over the next few months. Meantime, Russia's defense ministry says it has thwarted Ukrainian efforts to recapture Snake Island, located in the Black Sea. According to the ministry, the Russian army inflicted heavy casualties and damage on enemy forces in the area. Data from the United Nations show the war has so far displaced over 8 million Ukrainians internally. This on top of nearly 6 million others who've already left the country. Ukraine says it will suspend the use of a transit point for some Russian gas added to Europe and switch the flow to a new point. Russia says the move is inessential and impossible. Kiev says it will redirect gas flow from the current point located in an area under the control of Russian forces to another one in a Ukraine-controlled area. Kiev blames Moscow for the move, but Russia's Gazprom says it's technically impossible to shift all the gas to a new transit point. The Russian company says it sees no proof of any obstacle that necessitates such a move. Gazprom says Ukraine is going to halt gas flows on Wednesday morning. Ukraine is a major transit route for Russian gas to Europe. Meantime, Western countries are working to phase out Russian energy imports. Iran has called on Belgium and two other European countries to respond to objections concerning the conviction of an Iranian diplomat over an alleged bombing plot which Tehran deems unlawful. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says Tehran will keep up legal efforts to help free Asadullah Asadi, a diplomat at Iran's embassy in Austria. He was detained in Germany and sentenced to 20 years in prison in Belgium in 2018 after being accused of setting up a bomb attack against the anti-Iran terrorist group MKO. The spokesman said the whole case is a scenario acted out by the MKO to spread Iranophobia. He reiterated Iran's position that the detention, trial, and conviction of the diplomat were all violations of the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations. On Tuesday, a Belgian court dismissed appeals of three Iranians accused of participating in the plot. The deadlock between the UK and the EU over post-Brexit trading arrangements in Northern Ireland is once again taking center stage, with both sides issuing stern warnings. The British Prime Minister says the situation regarding the so-called Northern Ireland Protocol is now very serious. Boris Johnson added that the UK government would take action to protect peace and stability in Northern Ireland if necessary. British media also are reporting that the UK is set to ditch large parts of the protocol after giving up on talks with the bloc on the Brexit deal. On the other side, the German Chancellor has warned Britain against making any unilateral changes to the protocol.
We have found a good way forward for Northern Ireland, and no one should unilaterally scrap or break or in any way change the arrangements we agreed on together, especially because we know that this is a difficult and complicated question, which is not just about the European Union and the United Kingdom. It also impacts upon the prospect of peace in Ireland.
Scholz was speaking at a joint news conference with the Belgian Prime Minister, who echoed the German Chancellor's remarks. Alexander De Croo warned that revocation of the agreement would void the, quote, whole system. The Northern Ireland Protocol was part of the UK's divorce deal with the EU. It effectively created a customs border in the sea between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK to preserve the country's open land border with EU member state Ireland. However, tensions are once again surfacing over the issue after this week's elections in Northern Ireland. The largest unionist party there is now threatening not to take part in government unless the protocol is abandoned. Labour Party leader Sir Keir Starmer has pledged to step down if he's fined for potentially breaching COVID lockdown rules. Starmer and several members of his senior team are being investigated by Durham police after reports emerged that they had enjoyed a curry and drinks whilst assisting with a by-election campaign in the area. Labour officials have denied any breaches occurred, but must await the results of the investigation.
Opposition leader Sir Keir Starmer has been at the front of the chorus, urging Prime Minister Boris Johnson to do the decent thing and step down after being fined for his part in a series of lockdown gatherings dubbed Partygate. Now the Labour leader has become embroiled in a controversy of his own, nicknamed Currygate, after being pictured enjoying a meal and a drink in what the party's calling a work event, but one being dubbed an illegal gathering by his opponents.
First and foremost, no rules were broken. I don't actually believe that those that are accusing me believe rules were broken. They are trying to simply drag all politicians into a place where the public think we're all the same. For me, this is an in-principle position. No rules are broken. I'm absolutely clear about that. But in the event that I'm wrong about that and I get a fixed penalty notice, I will do the right thing and step down.
Political observers think this is a risky strategy.
Well, I think that his advisers think this is a really good ploy to contrast him with Boris Johnson, who, of course, didn't resign, having been fined for breaking the lockdown regulations. But it's a dangerous ploy as well, because he's not in control of what the police investigation is going to find. And if he does get fined, he's now been committed to resigning as leadership of the Labour Party.
The Labour Party had desperately wanted to take the moral high ground when it came to their handling of COVID rules and regulations, not just in the House of Commons, but in the court of public opinion. But now with their leader caught in the spotlight because of his own missteps, supporters of Boris Johnson are hoping to capitalize on this political mistake and make Labour pay. Whether or not the leader of the Labour Party is fined, for many of the electorate, this is yet another letdown. Politicians who seemingly are unwilling or unable to play by the rules. The police investigation could take as long as a month to conclude. Now Labour and its leader must play the waiting game and cross their political fingers that this high-stake gamble has paid off. Mina Taylor, London.
African Americans are 12 times more likely to be shot dead than white U.S. citizens. That's according to a report recently released by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The report also suggests that overall African Americans are at least four times more likely to be fatally shot compared to the rest of the U.S. population. The CDC also says deaths involving firearms in the United States went up by 35% in 2020, hitting its highest point in well over two decades. The report points to disparities in the rates of homicide based on race, ethnicity, and poverty. The study fails to single out a specific reason for such inequality, but cites the COVID-19 pandemic as a possible socioeconomic driving factor. According to an online archive of gun violence in the country, firearms cause approximately 40,000 deaths a year, including suicides. And South Korea's inaugurated conservative Yoon Suk-yeol is president following a divisive election. While many people voted for Yoon, hoping for a principled, market-oriented government, many others are concerned about his stance in regards with North Korea. Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
Of Yoon Suk-yeol was inaugurated president of South Korea in a ceremony in front of the country's National Assembly. Although President Yoon has vowed to take a hard line on North Korea, his address offered Pyongyang conditional assistance.
If North Korea genuinely embarks on a process to complete denuclearization, we are prepared to work with the international community to present an audacious plan that will vastly strengthen North Korea's economy and improve the quality of life for its people.
The South's President Yoon's words may ring hollow for North Korea, as President Yoon has promised to bolster the country's military deterrent and strengthen its alliance with the United States. Some analysts suggest that may be destabilizing.
The U.S.-South Korea alliance will improve considerably in the next 5 years of the Yoon Suk-yeol administration, but North Korea's nuclear capabilities will be enhanced and tensions on the Korean peninsula will heighten even more.
South Koreans want President Yoon to address a raft of domestic issues as well, including housing and economic disparity.
Stabilizing housing prices is a priority for me, and I would like to have economic policies that can make a better living for both corporations and individuals and cover blind spots in the current policies.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol wasted no time in demonstrating the hardline deterrent strategy his administration intends to take with North Korea. The U.S. and South Korean militaries began combined exercises with F-35 Joint Strike Fighter aircraft just hours before Yoon took office. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Well, that's a wrap for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, COVID-19 has become the third leading cause of death in the United States after heart disease and cancer. Amid all of this pain, President Joe Biden has dropped most pandemic restrictions, stopped most national tracking, and failed to act on even the most basic federal actions to rein this pandemic in. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Analia Mejia Ryder. This article is published under the heading, As U.S. Marks 1 Million COVID Deaths, Biden Has Dropped Most Pandemic Protections. Here's more. One million deaths. an unthinkable milestone when this pandemic started. And even this gruesome number doesn't capture who and what the U.S. has lost. 1 million lives lost, dreams unfulfilled, families heartbroken, and futures cut short. This loss is unimaginable, and the Americans have only just begun to scratch the surface of how their communities will continue to grapple with this mass death and violence, surely for generations to come. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, COVID-19 has become the third leading cause of death in the United States after heart disease and cancer. Amid all of this pain, President Joe Biden has dropped most pandemic restrictions, stopped most national tracking, and failed to act on even the most basic federal actions to rein this pandemic in. Disabled and chronically ill Americans have been left adrift. In a maskless world, many of people in the U.S. are unable to safely leave their homes. They need swift, immediate action at a global level. Fighting this pandemic as if they can defeat it alone has failed. It's time. Biden must work with Congress immediately to ensure that supplemental COVID funding includes significant global investments to end the pandemic. Americans' lives are at stake, and Americans cannot wait another moment. Heading into the third year of the pandemic, billions worldwide still don't have access to COVID vaccines and treatments, continuing to suffer even as pharmaceutical companies reach record profits. Globally, less wealthy nations have been abandoned to vaccine apartheid as pharmaceutical companies are selling and distributing vaccines, tests, and treatments almost exclusively to wealthy nations. In the U.S., it's communities of color, low-income people, and the disabled who face the greatest burden of COVID-19 in terms of death rates, but also economically and socially. Those working in lower-wage fields like food and agriculture, warehouse operations, transportation, and construction saw higher rates of death than in most other occupations. Working in a nursing home has become one of the deadliest jobs in the U.S. The consequences of this pandemic are far-reaching and devastating, not just for those Americans have lost, but for the ones they have left behind. They have the tools and resources necessary to support their communities and fight health inequity right now, but it's clear that what is missing is the political will to do so. The United States hasn't seen mass death on a scale like this since the Second World War, when about 418,000 Americans died. The Atlantic's Ed Young puts it into perspective. Quote, the U.S. reported more deaths from COVID-19 last Friday on March 4th than deaths from Hurricane Katrina, more on any two recent weekdays than deaths during the 9/11 terrorist attacks, more last month than deaths from flu in a bad season, and more in 2 years than deaths from HIV during the 4 decades of AIDS epidemic, unquote. Where is the U.S. great reckoning of this mass violence and pain? And more importantly, where is the political will to fight the future for the families, for a road ahead away from this destruction and toward justice, equality, health, and resources for all those still suffering and at risk of death? since it rejected a $15 billion supplemental for pandemic preparedness that included global vaccine outreach and funding for free vaccines and testing in the U.S., Congress has not provided Americans with the funding they need to continue a robust COVID response, even amid new variants and continued pandemic-related economic stress. With cases rising abroad, experts are sounding the alarm that Americans should expect a rise in cases in the U.S. as well. Failure to adequately fund these efforts now will have severe and far-reaching consequences, impacting the ability to deal with a future surge. Moreover, despite widespread messaging that COVID testing is free, many patients have found themselves facing bills for testing, some for over $1,000. According to the New York Times, about 2.4% of coronavirus tests billed to insurers in 2020 left the patient responsible for some portion of payment, adding up to hundreds of thousands of Americans who received unexpected bills. Patients were left with these high bills due to gaps in protections that Congress and the Trump administration put in place early in the pandemic. And the American communities are still suffering. While ensuring that people trust the vaccine is a high priority, it is also critical that unexpected costs for testing and treatment don't deter individuals from getting vaccinated. Democrats must pass supplemental funding without giving in to Republican demands to tie COVID funds to oppressive immigration policies. They cannot allow partisan distractions and anti-immigrant cruelty to distract from this urgent need. The time to act is now, and Americans cannot leave anyone behind. A new way of life is there, seemingly forever. But adjusting to the new normal is hardly enough, not when an average of 26,000 new cases are recorded every single day, bringing with them the threat of more death, more loss, more futures taken too soon. Mask mandates are being lifted across the U.S. There is no national funding to support those infected. Uninsured Americans have little to no support.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Last year today, that's on May 10th, 2021, the Tel Aviv regime launched a war on Gaza. Hundreds of civilians, including women and children, lost their lives or got wounded in the war that lasted 11 days. The fighting is stopped after fierce resistance by Palestinian groups and firing thousands of rockets at the regime, forcing it to declare a unilateral ceasefire.
A year ago, Israeli regime forces bombed hundreds of buildings in the Gaza Strip during the 11-day war, also known as the Sword of Al-Quds battle. The wanton Israeli attacks claimed the lives of over 260 Palestinians, including scores of children and women. The Gaza-based resistance groups Mili Hamas, the Islamic Jihad, and the Popular Resistance Committees also fired some 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzeddin al-Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli attacks on Palestinians in Al-Quds' Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. overwhelmed by the significantly developed military capabilities of Palestinian resistance factions, the Israeli regime was forced to announce a unilateral ceasefire.
During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinian resistance factions fired thousands of rockets against the Zionist regime, forcing it to desperately call for a ceasefire after 11 days. The resistance is prepared to respond to any aggression, and nowadays the military capabilities of the resistance are better than last year. The Zionist enemy must understand that attacking Al-Quds will result in a new war.
The 11-day war saw the heaviest fighting between Gaza resistance factions and Israeli regime forces since 2014. Over the past decade, Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza have been boosting their production capacity for homemade rockets and drones. During the May war, Israel's Iron Dome also proved to be a failure. The multi-million-dollar high-tech missile system was unable to protect the Israeli regime.
During the 11-day war last year, 2021, Hamas and the Palestinians scored very well against Israel in a number of things. One is the launching of rockets against Israel closed very much Israeli airports, port, and the Israeli business community. In addition to that, the Palestinians succeeded in unifying all fronts.
The Israeli regime has waged four wars on the Gaza Strip since 2007 under the watchful eye of the international community.
Experts believe in any future war, the Israeli regime will be dealt a heavy blow by Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and these are our guests in today's episode of The Spotlight. Attorney, activist, and political analyst Zakir Ahmed Mayat is joining us out of Johannesburg. Also with us will be journalist and activist Khaled Barakat from Vancouver.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, both gentlemen. Now, let me ask Zakir. Let's begin, Zakir, our discussion by considering the fact that this time around, unlike the previous wars where we had some mediators, this time it was Israel that asked for a ceasefire. What does this signify?
Well, definitely, I think it's a correct reflection of the facts. Israel is a very different state to what it once was. It has now become a glorified police force as opposed to one of the most powerful militaries on the face of this earth. What this signifies is a complete collapse and erosion of the very fundamentals of the state of Israel. Israel was established on the principle of terror. Deir Yassin, we are very familiar of the massacres of Deir Yassin and the terror that was caused and sown into the Palestinian population to allow for mass exodus. This policy becomes cemented, if I can use that word, in 1967 when Arik Shrinum and Ariel Sharon says that the key principle is deterrence capacity, the Arabs' fear of us. And that is the fundamental that is used for many years and even tries to find its roots in 2006 under the instructions of Major General Giora Island, and closer to home, the head of Northern Command was Hadi Eisenkot. This shows us that after 2006, after the first head-on defeat of Israeli Zionist apartheid colonial settler regime at the hands of the Hezbollah, it has never been able to recover. And now it's not even able to wage an effective war against the starved and besieged population in Gaza or the subjugated occupied Palestinians. It's the end of the Israeli state, and we're seeing it with our eyes.
Mm-hmm. Now, Khaled, what do you think makes Israel regime's last year war on Gaza different? How was it different from the rest of the Israeli invasions?
It was different because the Palestinian resistance involvement in this engagement have unified all Palestinian people behind it, and also it unified not just Palestinians in Palestine from the river to the sea, but also Palestinians in the diaspora as well. And we saw that this time it was different because the Palestinians inside Israel, inside 1948 occupied territories, they were fully engaged and participant in the uprising, the uprising of unity, as some Palestinian called them. And at the same time, it was different because Palestinians have actually demonstrated a very well-organized resistance, where all forms of actions were carried on by Palestinians, whether in the West Bank or Jerusalem or in Lid, in Yaffa, and also outside in the diaspora. And I think that when Palestinians are united, not just in a sentimental way, but in reality and in the program of struggle, we began to see a division in the Zionist regime, internal situation. So when Palestinians are united, also it showed that the Palestinian Authority was irrelevant to this whole scene, and that those Palestinians who have been advocating for negotiations with Israel or security cooperation with Israel were very much marginalized and, put on the side. Palestinians definitely have won in this last round of confrontation.
Now, Zakir, let's now talk about the recent tension and escalation that you hear in the news almost every day in the occupied territories. What factors, in your opinion, have been responsible for the tit-for-tat operations almost on a daily basis?
I think it does find its roots in last year's Operation Cycle Quds. And this was a declaration by Israel's own internal military sources, particularly the Miramid Center for Counterterrorism and Intelligence, where they openly declare that a new equation is on the ground. The equation is, if there are any aggressions or attempts to change the status of Beit al-Maqdis, of al-Quds, there will be a response. What has changed, and we've seen it now in the last few days, is that Israel has been awoken to a new form of operation. So usually they expect a retaliation from Gaza in the form of projectiles, rockets, etc., mortar shells. However, what we are seeing is operations being conducted within the borders of Israel, and this has truly shaken the fundamentals of the Israeli state. What does that mean? The fundamentals of the Israeli state is that they want a war at a distance. They are not a population that can handle confrontation on a day-to-day basis. They are comfortable, they are soft, and they are entitled and privileged, much like the Afrikaner was here in apartheid South Africa. He was entitled, he was privileged, and the African population was fine the distance. It was when the battle is brought to the home front, that is when the situation changed here in South Africa, and I believe that the people of Palestine are in that exact position now. There's a massive change in the modus operandi, and it does put Israel at a massive disadvantage because they don't have the capacity to deal with a multi-front operational attack.
Mm-hmm. Khaled, the Tel Aviv regime has given its troops full freedom to kill Palestinians. You know, they spot the Palestinians who attack the soldiers, which is a natural response. They kill them, and then they go and attack their villages and towns and destroy their homes. What will be the result of such a practice?
Well, Israel have been doing this since its establishment, the collective punishment of the Palestinian population. And we see this over and over on a daily basis, particularly because they want to make Palestinian resistance very costly for the Palestinian people. They know that the only way and the only reason that we have a strong Palestinian armed resistance is because it has a popular incubator and a popular support. No resistance would be able to continue its task without people's support. So Israel wants to punish our people every time, there is an action of resistance. We saw that in Jenin lately. We saw that also in other villages and towns in the West Bank. And they want the Palestinians to start, what they call the burning of conscience operation in Jenin in 2003. And that is to, push Palestinians into despair, starvation, making their life, daily life, difficult. But again and again, Palestinians for the past 74 years have demonstrated an iron will in terms of their ability to carry on the tasks of struggle. And that's because resistance for Palestinians is not a matter of like just a decision that people make. It's a way of life. Existence is resistance, for Palestinians, whether they are in the West Bank or whether they are in Gaza or Jerusalem or in the diaspora.
Mm-hmm. Zakaria, as you know, the Israeli land grab policy is being pushed further every day. Palestinians are losing more and more of their land and their homes. The settlement expansion is going on. We have 700,000 Israelis living there. So what's on the horizon for the Palestinians? Also on the excuse that they have no construction permits, they're losing their homes, they're being demolished, and no such permits are being issued for the Palestinians. So how much more of their lands will the Palestinians be losing?
I'm going to address your question in two parts. The first, I'd just like to touch on the response of the fellow guest and a colleague. I think I agree on this part, that they are trying to create a cost for the resistance operation, but they failed to do that in Lebanon through 006. They rolled out something called the Dahiya principle. For each rocket, they have to level a neighborhood in Lebanon so as to cause pressure on the Hezbollah. Today, Hezbollah is stronger than it's ever been. So this principle is doomed to failure. And similarly, I'm going to extrapolate that principle and place it to the question that you posed to me. Is that what is the future when so much of Palestinian land is being gobbled by the Israeli machinery? And Israel is painting itself into a corner. It's a very obvious position now, because Israel is facing something called a one-state reality. It is impossible to argue a two-state solution based on secured borders and other ridiculous principles that Israel pulls out of thin air. The reality is now that it is impossible to establish a Palestinian state. It has to be now a one-state solution. You have to look at a South Africa solution, and this means it's the death of the Zionist enterprise. These aren't my words, the words of Ehud Barak and so many others, Tzipi Livni said it at the IDC Hezlia conference a few years ago, and they've said it, that if we do not give equal rights to Palestinians under a one-state banner, we are going to slip into apartheid state, which it already is, and this has been recognized by groupings like Bat Salem, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch. The entire world, I've said this before, the entire world is on one side, and Israel is still holding on to the relic of apartheid, which has already been thrown into the rubbish bin of history.
Mm-hmm. Now, Khaled, when you take a glance at the goings-on in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, especially in the past few years, you realize that the more violence and the more crimes committed against the Palestinians, the more resilient they have become, and the more retaliatory and stronger operations they have conducted. So the question is, why shouldn't the Tel Aviv regime not change the policy? Why should it still stick to the same old, heavy-handed tactics against Palestinians?
Because the nature of the Zionist regime is a colonialist settler project that is serving the interests of imperialist forces and of the United States, and particularly the Israeli regime serves also the Israeli capitalist ruling class in this regime. So this is the nature of Israel. Israel cannot exist if it's not an expansionist state, an aggressive state, a state that commits crimes against Palestinian people, and just not just Palestinian people, but also against its neighbors, against its, you know, like the Arab people in general. And we know that there is not one single Arab country that was not attacked by Israel in one form or another. And so that's the nature of a colonialist settler state. And Israel is doomed to fail as a project because the continuation of crimes and massacres and wars, it will only lead to more Palestinian resistance, but it would also would lead to more support for the natural solution, and that is the liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea, and the establishment of a society that has nothing to do with Zionism and racism and Israel. It must be a secular democratic state that people live from the river to the sea under rule.
Okay.
Africa has a lot of similar what is being so always but that just solution in Palestine must contain the right of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes.
Now, Zakir, what type of a strategy would you expect a Tel Aviv regime to adopt in the face of Palestinians in the future? Would you expect any change?
Unfortunately, I don't see any prospects of change. I think the system of terrorism, apartheid, genocide, colonialism, and this general occupation mentality is ingrained within Israeli society. It's hard to break free from the mold when Israel was established on terror, continues to practice terror, and will demise while practicing terror. I think the answer to the situation is to continue with the formula. The Palestinian resistance movement in the joint operations rooms have embarked on the principle of Dawla al-Wahda, the mm-hmm. joint movement now. What we are seeing now is, and this is a very key feature of this this conflict right now, is that it's not only the Palestinians. Israel tried to undermine BDS. It's cut the feet of BDS by normalizing with certain Arab states and trying to attract the wealth from these Arab states. But what has happened in the opposite arena is that you have this massive arc of resistance that is ready to put soldiers and arms at the disposal of the Palestinians and join them in the fight, in the final fight for the destruction of the state of Israel if it does not reform, which it won't. You have Hezbollah in the north. You have Hashd al-Shaabi in Iraq in the last war, 2021, Saif al-Quds. Hashd al-Shaabi was already dispatching troops for the possibility of a large war. You have Ansarullah in Yemen. You have the Palestinians both in the West Bank and in Gaza, and as our dear brother has said, also within Israel proper. You have a complete system that is engulfing Israel, and Israel has no option but to continue with his brutality, and that is how the apartheid regime did the same thing until they read the writing on the wall. The question is, can Israel read?
Mm. Good question. Now, Khaled, Zakir talked about what the Israelis are going to do. What about the Palestinians, given the situation, you know, so-called normalizations and mediations that failed? And also, of course, we have social media. We have people taken to the streets, even in Western countries, in Europe, in support of Palestinians. But on the ground, they're not receiving much practical kind of support for their cause. So what are they supposed to do?
Well, one of the most important tasks today for Palestinians, and that's an internal Palestinian task, is to establish the Palestinian National Unified Front that could not just carry the tasks of the struggle and resistance in terms of confrontation with the Zionist regime, but also the political tasks. And we have seen the complete failure of the Palestinian Authority and the illusion bath of negotiations. This Palestinian sector that have led the Palestinian Liberation Organization since Oslo until today have failed, and a new leadership has to emerge from Palestinian resistance. And we see that the Palestinian resistance in Gaza, for example, despite all the harsh conditions that they are experiencing, they maintain a unified internal front. We see in Gaza, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, from nationalists to Marxists to religious groups are united in one joint leadership. But this is not enough. It has to translate itself into a political project that it's understood and clear by Palestinians, mm-hmm. and it will be forced on the so-called international community. That is a very tough task, but it is achievable because Palestinians have done this before, you know, and at least. And so they are to do this.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this show. Attorney, activist, and political activist Zakir Ahmed Mayat in Johannesburg, journalist and activist Khaled Barakat in Vancouver. Thank you very much for your insight and input. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi. I'll see you next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam,
the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام متى أشفي غيظي إذا غضبت أحين أعجز عن الانتقام فيقال لي لو صبرت أم حين أقدر عليه فيقال لي لو عفوت.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam used to say, "If I am angry, when shall I vent my anger? When I am unable to take revenge, and it be said to me, better you endure, or when I have power to take revenge, and it be said to me, better forgive."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. We find, dear friends, in the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, that Imam Ali was an individual who looked towards Allah. He had tawakkul, trust and reliance upon Allah. And he had his hopes on Allah. We do not find in any place that Imam Ali alayhi salam put forth his hand out in need from another human being. Whenever he raised his hands or whenever he put forth his hand out of need, it was towards the Almighty Allah. And so here we find a very interesting aspect of the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And in his own words, His Eminence, the first disciple, the first imam, the first successor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, he says, "Whoever sets their hope on others, that person on whom they set their hope upon creates an awe and glory in your heart." So in case it was a little bit confusing, so Imam Ali alayhi salam is saying that this person who you set your hopes upon, that person, their awe and their glory and their respect and their honor is created in your heart. So here we have two aspects. One aspect is this, that if we hope and rely upon another human being, then we will have awe and glory and honor in our hearts regarding that individual. When in reality, an individual is not upon whom we should pin our hopes upon. For it is Allah who ultimately gives, and it is Allah who ultimately takes. And so this in context, and this in mind, we realize that